Guardian.
HS2 finally gets the go-ahead, Sinn Féin claims victory in Ireland, and the Prime Minister prepares for a cabinet reshuffle. I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly.
The night time is the right time to fight crime. I can't think of a rhyme.
Have you lost your influence now, is that the case, or have you changed your mind on HS2?
I think we need PJ Masks on the job.
If you can't tell from that cryptic response, Boris Johnson's chief advisor Dominic Cummings was dropping a heavy hint that the government was poised to give the go-ahead to the controversial HS2 project. Work on the high-speed rail line is due to begin in weeks, despite the fact that costs are expected to exceed £100 billion. The Prime Minister also announced on Tuesday that he'll be appointing an HS2 minister whose full-time job will be to oversee the project and shake up its management structure. You might say Johnson wants to take back control. An HS2 minister is just one of the new appointments expected on Thursday, when Johnson's tipped to announce a reshuffle of his cabinet, though perhaps not the drastic cull that was being mooted before Christmas. The chat at Westminster is that some of the most radical changes to the Whitehall machine, favoured by Cummings, have been watered down or postponed, perhaps an indicator that Johnson doesn't have quite the same revolutionary zeal as his best-known advisor. We'll talk about who's up, who's down, and what it all means. Over in Ireland, Sinn Féin, the Nationalist Party, who many never expected to see gain enough support to be in government, shocked pretty much everyone when they won the popular vote and more seats in the Irish Parliament than at any time since the founding of the Republic. But now starts the real fun, as the two former stalwart parties of Irish politics, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have to grapple with the idea of forming a pact with a historic enemy. So how will this all play out? And we'll also hear the latest in the Labour leadership contest. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, in January, Boris Johnson announced that he'd got Brexit done. And yesterday, he announced his next goal.
So today, Mr. Speaker, the Cabinet has given high-speed rail the green signal. We are going to get this done.
That's right. After years of arguments and back and forth, this Tory government has finally committed to finishing the HS2 high-speed rail line project. Well, at least most of it. He promised the completion of the infamous London to Birmingham rail line. The second phase, which includes lines further north, is going to somehow be merged into a mega high-speed project called Northern Powerhouse Rail. So what now? When should we expect to see journey times halved? And what leaves can the project leaders still expect to see on the line? The Guardian's transport correspondent Gwyn Topham breaks it down for us in this short report.
HS2 was first proposed as the kind of scheme we know today in 2009, but under the Labour government. It took 2 or 3 years of wrangling under the coalition before they gave it the green light with a pretty firm route on the map. Since then, there's been further debates as it goes through Parliament as they've honed out the exact route, whether more tunnels should be built. And then we've got to where we are today, which is really probably mainly a function of Boris Johnson having run for party leader and having to convince his own members to vote for him. Because among Tory party members, particularly HS2, is very unpopular. So he made this quick pledge on the campaign trail to put it under review, made a quick call to his friend Douglas Ogilvy to review it. And then this review has come with this enormous weight of expectation. But what we're really seeing today is that we're pretty much where we were a year ago, which is that HS2 is being built from London to Birmingham, and it still needs to be pinned down and passed by Parliament to go any further north. The headline is certainly very welcome for supporters of high-speed rail. Politicians in the north have welcomed it. Certainly people working on the scheme, from unions to business to the contractors, are very pleased. But I think some people still wait to see the detail. They still wonder what exactly will happen with Phase 2B. But certainly given where everyone was a few months ago when the whole scheme looked to be in jeopardy, when the government was considering where to proceed at all, people who wanted that scheme will be pretty happy.
This is a fantastic project for the country. It delivers massive...
We're not going to see anything soon, so don't hold your breath. But what we do know is that work will continue, as it has been already, on London to Birmingham. There'll probably be a lot more protest now in some places because the programme of tree felling in some controversial areas has been paused. But work will ramp up. There's some big contracts that need to be signed off by the Treasury. When that happens, we'll start seeing major construction work from London to Birmingham. That could happen later this year, possibly. And then after that, I think we'll see a lot more wrangling about what happens post-Birmingham. A bit like Brexit. It's one of these things we've got done, but have we really got it done? We'll have to wait and see. It's true that Boris Johnson loves an infrastructure project, He also says he loves the bus. And it's true, he's not maybe always the biggest details man. I think he's got nothing to lose by pledging all this. He's probably not going to be in power before any of it happens, but it would be nice to be have his name slapped on the side of one of those high-speed trains. I can't see why he wouldn't commit. It's another of those things that I think could help level up the regions if that's what he's really interested in. And it ticks a lot of boxes. It's interesting that some of his advisors are against it, but I think what you see maybe with the Prime Minister is a sense of what will, in the end, be a monument and what might be popular with the most people, even if lots of people this time don't like it, and that's presented with more of an awkward choice than normal.
The Guardian's transport correspondent Gwyn Topham there. Back in the studio, I'm joined by the political correspondent for the New Statesman, Alva Ray, Paul Harrison, the former press secretary to Theresa May, who currently works at PR firm Lexington, and Anand Menon, director of the UK in a Changing Europe. Paul, we heard a bit from Gwyn about why this has taken so long and how complex it's been. Why was this decision to press ahead not made earlier? Why has this taken so long?
I mean, there is clearly a genuine split in terms of the people who are advising the Prime Minister about the merits of the project. It takes sometimes a while to reconcile those things. And also, we're just not very good at building big infrastructure projects in this country. And it's a controversial thing to spend 100 billion quid of anybody's money. And that's what the announcement looks like, because the estimated costs have risen really significantly since it was announced, you know, in, what was it, 1300 BC. and so, look, it's a contentious thing and these things take time. But as I say, it looks like Boris has expressed a very clear view, has overruled some internal opposition to a project. And
yeah, including Mr. Cummings, right, who's known to be a bit sceptical about it.
I mean, it certainly sounds that way, and it doesn't sound like he's alone in terms of the Number 10 advisory team in expressing scepticism. But, you know, with a majority this large and a vision for the future that involves regional growth, I'd always thought it was a bit of a no-brainer.
Alva, the Prime Minister sort of wrapped it up, didn't he, with quite a few local transport announcements, partly to say where it fitted within his sort of vision of Britain, but also to try and placate some of those Conservative MPs who were concerned that the enormous cost of the scheme meant that their local transport wouldn't improve for decades, right? So we're going to be a very long time before we see any trains on this line.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think it was an effort to address some people's concerns about whether this will actually involve genuine investment and improvement in the north. I thought that Emily Thornberry on Politics Live yesterday made quite a good point about this, that this was designed as a package of measures to improve the north under, you know, the Northern Powerhouse idea with George Osborne. But the HS2 building began in London and it's running out of money as it approaches the north. And HS3, which was this great idea to connect the north as well, has been kind of abandoned. And, you know, it was meant to be part of a package of measures, as you say, to, you know, connect the smaller towns and villages around these big cities as well. And that was also sort of forgotten. So I think probably Boris Johnson's announcement yesterday that there would be further investment in sort of cycle lanes and bus routes was quite important. But on HS2 more generally, I just think it's just so frustrating how badly it's been communicated. I sort of die inside every time there's a discussion on TV and someone says, oh, I just don't understand why we're spending all these billions of pounds to get to Birmingham 7 minutes quicker. And I just think, how have we had this discussion for this long and it hasn't trickled through into our discourse or in like into the collective imagination that it's about, you know, building capacity? And the, you know, the increases in speed are sort of, you know, they're a handy bonus, but they're not the main aim of the.
And it's about freeing up local lines, isn't it?
Well, exactly,
which are currently held up while the sort of through train from London goes through. You know, it's about making local lines work better too.
Yeah, like we have a growing population. Eventually, there will just be too many people trying to go on our railways if we don't have some sort of complement and subsidy for it.
And now this is a Prime Minister, isn't it, who sees infrastructure as being part of his sort of vision of Britain. You know, he sort of talks about Pericles of Athens, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Built a few marble bits
and bobs, tunnels and roads and rail. I mean, it's true, it is an odd way to signal your commitment to the north to dig a massive great hole at Euston Station and say, you know, sometime in the next half a century we might reach you. But I mean, the point is absolutely well made that this is about capacity and it's needed. And just the ham-fistedness of this government and the last when it comes to selling that idea that it isn't about those, you know, it isn't about being able to pop to Birmingham from Leeds for lunch. Mm. That's not the point of this investment, but it is needed. And what concerns me is just how bad we are at project management and at seeing these things through. And I think it's well past time we started looking at ourselves and figuring out why it is we're just so bad at these things.
Yeah, and it's something that's been said about Britain for decades, isn't it? That this is not something we're very good at. It's interesting the extent to which the Prime Minister has now sort of stamped his identity on this, isn't it? He didn't send his Transport Secretary out to make the announcement. He made it himself. You know, he made quite lavish promises about lower fares and, you know.
And it was pretty fulsome. I mean, he didn't. Yeah. It wasn't a decision he was sort of seeking to minimise or run away from. He saw it because I think it's part of his political shtick, but actually his political makeup. He likes to see himself as an optimist, so he sold an optimistic version of the project in the Commons yesterday, and I thought it was quite well done on that basis. There were too many decisions, I think, in the administration that I was part of, which you have to sort of be seen to do reluctantly, because some of them were pretty invidious choices. But there is value in saying, we're going to do this, it's going to be really good, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I'll be well out of office by the time anyone knows.
Well, there is that, yeah. But although we'll all still be calling it the you know, potentially we'll be calling it, you know, Boris's project long afterwards, because he's now, and woe betide that minister who's going to have that job of delivering.
Yeah, you don't want that, do you? Don't answer your phone.
And Alva, if HS2 is going to take quite a long time, how long do you think we'll be waiting for this bridge from Scotland to
Northern Ireland? Yeah. Gosh. I mean, so I tweeted that, you know, maybe we should do a cable car instead, because those cable cars in East London are apparently only used by 4 regular commuters. And Aisha Hazarika said, oh, maybe a zip wire. I mean, I think that, you know, being Northern Irish, I think that, you know, people travel from Northern Ireland to all parts of the rest of the UK very regularly for work. You know, people commute to London for work and people commute to Edinburgh, Glasgow, Manchester. I think that that probably does respond to some sort of desire or need for non-flight based travel between the two. Like, there are ferries, but they, to be honest, are a bit grim. And, you know, I think that some kind of improved and more environmentally friendly way of travelling between Northern Ireland and the mainland would be quite a good idea. But, you know, isn't there lots of nuclear waste in the Irish Sea?
I think it's unexploded ordnance. Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, like, so Second World War ordnance was dumped there. Yeah.
Just like it's a sort of no-goer, isn't it?
Certainly seems like it. I mean, there is this sort of part of Boris Johnson's personality, isn't there, where he clearly likes these big projects and he clearly likes being the person who looks at something totally impossible and says, don't worry, guys, you know, there must be a way of doing it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there is a bit, he's very good at understanding political symbolism. It's always been one of his strengths. There is something that speaks to a kind of unionist argument about that as an infrastructure project. I wouldn't put it any stronger than that, but there is a bit of signalling involved.
But they'd have to build a customs post at one end of it at least.
Yeah, they would.
Which would be interesting.
Yeah, they would. I mean, it's a sort of extraordinary...
Yeah. The symbolism of that would be less good, yeah.
That would definitely be not so good. And HS2 is not the only decision we're expecting this week. There's been a lot of talk, Paul, for months now, it seems, certainly since before Christmas, that once we'd got Brexit done, the Prime Minister was going to reshuffle his cabinet, you know, that he first filled his team with people who were super loyal Brexiters, and that now he's, you know, he's going to sort of rebuild Britain and he needs a different team to do that. You've seen a reshuffle or two. What's it like in Downing Street on days like Thursday?
I mean, the first thing to say is, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's been signalled for some time. There's been lots of dark murmurings emanating from Number 10 for some time about the desire for Boris essentially to stamp his authority on government. And so it's long awaited. We'll see what form it takes. The process of actually doing a reshuffle is just an exercise in organised chaos, really. You know, well, you start with a series of competing arguments about essentially who you like and who you don't, and there will be lots of views inside Number 10 about the relative strengths of the cabinet at the moment. Then it all sort of takes physical form when a whiteboard gets wheeled into the PM's office with little magnets.
An actual whiteboard.
Little magnets, all the departments drawn up on one side, and then pieces of sort of card for everybody's name. Things get interesting during the course of the day because, of course, at the start of the day, before the switchboard from a withheld number starts to make the calls to get people to come into Downing Street, you have a vision of what the cabinet looks like at the end of the day. But that's based on everybody accepting the positions that they're given and being fine with, in some cases, being sacked. When you get people who say, I won't move, my old boss, Jeremy Hunt, was slated to be moved from health to business once.
Yeah, that was a long day, wasn't it, I remember?
It was, and I was sort of sent off as his former advisor, sit in a side room and say, the merits of this, you know, are many and varied. And he said, there aren't any merits of it, I'm not doing it. And so I had to report my complete failure back. But that's when it gets difficult, because particularly towards the end of the day, you've obviously you've given away the big jobs. There are certain great offices of state that have to be filled. For example, we can't not have a defense secretary. So for all sorts of reasons involving pressing buttons. But by the end of the day, you don't have much wiggle room because you've announced the jobs as you go. And if somebody says, I'm not taking this move, and you say, well, okay, but you're not staying in post, then it gets really difficult.
And then, and there are journalists, meanwhile, outside waiting in the street with television cameras who've watched them go in sometimes, or we're hoping they'll come out, and we're all speculating like mad on Twitter.
Often, if you're asking people to leave the government and you're not offering them anything else, then you might do those conversations in the PM's office, which is over in the House of Commons, if only because there are reporting restrictions on cameras. So you don't have someone who comes out of the office who's been very obviously sacked, and you don't expose them to that.
It sounds like a complete nightmare. And Alva, is that one of the reasons why this reshuffle this week might be a bit less radical than we were first expecting?
I suppose I'm expecting to be surprised, because I find the last reshuffle quite surprising. And I remember being surprised by the scope of the change and the way Boris Johnson was signalling quite so strongly a decisive break with Theresa May. I was at the Red Lion as the evening went on, and Priti Patel, their government building sort of behind that pub in Westminster, and she sort of walked up the side in these huge high heels. She had to walk really, really slowly, and she had this big sort of smirk on her face. And
that is her trademark look, to be fair.
And everyone was sort of, whispering, oh, there's Priti Patel. And then, she'd do the whole walk up to Downing Street, and then, she came back Home Secretary. And I just thought that was so sort of delicious from a pure sort of Westminster human drama perspective, that she was walking to have this huge reversal of fortunes, having been sacked in a previous cabinet. But I think because of that, we hadn't really expected everyone who had backed Hunt to be ousted from government. And, the messaging of that reshuffle was quite significant. I'm wondering if something similar will happen with this. This idea that they're now going to prioritise competence over the sort of the messaging or the implicit messaging of who the people are. I wonder what that will look like.
Anand, what should we be looking out for in terms of a kind of statement intent as to what kind of government Johnson wants this to be?
I mean, there are two sets of things out there. There's personalities, which is always fascinating. So Priti Patel's an interesting case, isn't she? Because she was very, very obviously benched during the election campaign. But she doesn't strike me as the sort of person you'd necessarily want on your backbenches. So, I mean, Michael Gove's the other fascinating one, of course. He and the Prime Minister have a long and tortured history. All the rumours suggest that he's going to essentially take over some kind of super department now.
Chief executive of government is the phrase that gets used a bit, doesn't it? Yeah.
So that's the sort of the gossipy stuff. I mean, it's important, but it's sort of gossipy. And then there's the whole machinery of government thing, isn't there? Which was, there has been a lot of talk about Dominic Cummings wanting to shake up Whitehall, wanting far fewer people in the cabinet, wanting these massive super ministries. It sounds at the moment like virtually none of that is going to happen. And the broader point about that is, to date, this has been a government, and I think the same applies to HS2, that talks a very, very good game, but hasn't particularly shown any signs of delivering on some of the rhetoric it's come out with. That's to say, you hear all these stories about dramatic changes in Whitehall. When the reshuffle comes, you're slightly underwhelmed. So,
and how much different do those sort of big machinery of government changes, MOG changes, the civil servants call them, don't they? How much difference do they actually make? Sort of reshaping departments, bashing them together, making up new ones?
No.
It does. I mean, it can make some difference. I mean, if you take the fate of DEXU, for instance, getting rid of DEXU and basically sticking what was left in the Cabinet Office working with Number 10 strikes me as very sensible, because this is the sort of negotiation that needs the hand of the Prime Minister all over it. You can't allow for a separate power centre as existed under DEXU for this. Otherwise, you get mixed messaging. So it can be really, really important. If you create some great sort of monolith that is ungovernable, remember Peter Mandelson's empire in business, for instance. So he got the sense that he wasn't quite aware of how much he was in control of.
Business and the Treasury that's a really old kind of rivalry, isn't it? And that who does economic policy and how many bits of it do you get endlessly rearranged, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I think in that case, I think personality is more important than machinery of government, because essentially that argument is settled by how powerful the Chancellor of the day is. Mm. I think you're absolutely right. It's the human drama that's the interesting thing here.
Yeah.
It's a big signal about the type of government that Boris wants to lead. The other thing is that it is an exercise in making enemies. a thesis that I occasionally try to push is that Boris will never be more powerful than the moment immediately before the phone calls start. Because at that point, everybody's on best behaviour. And by the end of the day, however extensive this reshuffle is, he would have made some enemies for life.
Yeah, absolutely. Chancellor appears to be safe, we think, Anand.
Well, we'd heard that he was the only person who'd been guaranteed his job. And then we had all this slew of stories about the fact that he's at war with Dominic Cummings. I mean, my guess would be yes, but who knows?
Paul, at what point does an advisor like Cummings become too much of the story?
Well, I mean, there is a rule of thumb, isn't there, that, you know, the moment the spokesman needs a spokesman, it's time to go. And that obviously applied to Alistair Campbell. It's not quite the same for Dom Cummings because, you know, he doesn't have that sort of press role.
He's not meant to be a spokesman. He's not meant to speak to the media, is he, really?
Well, I mean, yeah, Spads traditionally don't really, apart from people who are sort of specifically have that as part of their job. I suspect, to be honest, he's having a bit of fun with it and is interested and struck by the fact that some of us are talking about it, frankly. I mean, I had to look up the sort of owl-like creatures that he was referring to.
The PJ masks.
There we are, yeah. yesterday, but I suspect he'll find it quite funny that people are even talking about that, which is clearly a non-comment about anything.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. After the break, Rory Carroll explains why the Irish general election result was truly historic and we catch up on the latest in the Labour leadership contest. We'll be right back.
Bookmarked an article but never returned to read it? You're not alone. With The Guardian's Audio Long Reads podcast, you can listen to expert writing on a diverse range of issues whenever suits you. From immigration...
At each appeal, she was refused the right to stay in the country.
...to cult novelists.
He could not avoid writing murder on his list of options.
For long-form journalism without all the reading, listen to The Guardian's Audio Long Reads on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, in January and off the back of the impressive Brexit negotiations, the Irish Taoiseach Leo Varadkar called for a snap general election. He hoped the voters would reward him and his Fine Gael party and gift them a third term in power. Instead, the electorate dealt them and the entire political establishment a punishing blow, producing one of the most historic election results in the Republic's history. The Guardian's Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll predicts the potential fallout in Ireland in this report.
Obviously, this election was all about change. Sinn Féin went to the people and we convinced them in very, very large numbers that we are the alternative, that we are the vehicle for change.
By last Friday, political commentators were certainly expecting Sinn Féin to do well, but still not quite as well as the party ended up doing. Sinn Féin won almost a quarter of first preference votes. And that makes it the most popular party in a fragmented political landscape. So it actually outpolled Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the two traditionally dominant parties in Irish politics. And in addition to this, now that we have final results and the allocation of the seats in the parliament in Dáil Éireann, we've seen that Sinn Féin has again exceeded even more expectations because the party has won 37 seats, Fianna Fáil has won 38, and Fine Gael is on 35. And this in itself is a tie between Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil because Fianna Fáil, one of their seats will be go to the Speaker. So Sinn Féin have actually are now tied with Fianna Fáil, and this is despite the fact that they ran only half the number of candidates. So absolutely astonishing result for Sinn Féin.
It is about solving the housing crisis. It's about getting to grips with the crisis in our health services. It's about giving families...
So the reason people embraced Sinn Féin was a sense of fatigue with Fine Gael, which had been in office for almost a decade, and frustration that the main opposition party, Fianna Fáil, seemed so samey to the governing party. And there was a sense of itsy and bitsy, tweedledum, tweedledee, and that while the economy has been doing well, a lot of people felt left behind by economic growth. They felt that, well, what's the point of having Ireland having Europe's best GDP growth rates if I can't pay my mortgage or if I can't pay my insurance costs? Because the cost of living here has become so difficult for people that people are angry and they're also frustrated at the fraying of public services, especially the health services, and homelessness is growing. So the vote for Sinn Féin was a vote of frustration that the status quo did not appear to be taking these problems seriously enough.
The results, as you know, are still coming in from around the country. It seems that we have now a three-party system, three parties all getting roughly the same number of votes.
Apart from Sinn Féin's victory, the big losers are Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Now, Fine Gael was the ruling party of Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach. Now, they've been in power for 9 years, and they were going for an unprecedented third term. So they knew that they were going to be facing a headwind of just voter apathy. And so the fact that Fine Gael did quite badly is not a huge surprise. It is a very big disappointment for Varadkar, though, because he was elected by the party 3 years ago in the hope that he would be able to be a big vote getter and that he could defy political gravity and deliver a third term for Fine Gael. Now, instead, Fine Gael have lost more than 10 seats, so this is actually quite a bad result for them. But the even bigger losers are Fianna Fáil, who were the main opposition party. And they would normally have been expected to be the beneficiaries of an election which was a change election. The voters were fed up with the status quo and wanted change. So, well, here's the opposition party. But they were punished by voters, apparently because they had been supporting the Fine Gael government in a confidence and supply deal, which means that they weren't really able to ride this wave of change. They looked to many voters as these kind of crusty status quo party and who were not credible as agents of change. And so for Micheál Martin, the Fianna Fáil leader, this is a terrible result.
Well, we've been in touch with the Greens, with the Social Democrats, with People Before Profit. And there are others.
Now begins phase two of the Irish democratic process, and it's just as important as phase one, which was the election. Now, in a fragmented political landscape, it's all down to the party leaders to see who, if anybody, can cobble together a coalition that will have at least 80 seats in the Dáil. So there's going to be weeks, perhaps even months, of shadow boxing, horse trading, negotiating between all the party leaders to see if anybody can put together a viable ruling alliance. Now, this would be very difficult because we have, the three big parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, all have stark political differences between them. So for any of those three to combine together would be quite difficult.
And for us, a coalition with Sinn Féin is not an option.
Fine Gael is out of the running in a sense because Leo Varadkar has emphatically ruled out doing any deal with Sinn Féin. And given the Fine Gael showing in the polls, it seems almost for sure that Fine Gael will go into opposition. So the question really will be whether Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin can make a deal. Of course, another outcome, plausible outcome, will be months and months of negotiations ending in deadlock and no viable coalition emerging, and then we'll be looking at another election. So Ireland may be entering a very bumpy period of uncertainty. This election was seismic, a much overused word in politics these days, but really it was, because for a century Ireland has been very remarkably stable, and that's because voters would choose Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, alternating from one party to the other. And that has now been completely overturned, because we now have Sinn Féin, a left-wing party with a Republican agenda, as one of the dominant political forces now. So instead of a two-party political system, we have a three-party system. One of those parties is left-wing. And in Ireland, that counts as revolution.
Alva, you wrote a piece before the election questioning whether or not Irish voters would ever turn their back on the status quo, the two-party system. So were you shocked when you saw that exit poll?
So that piece was rather fate temptingly entitled "The Surge of Sinn Féin." So I had sort of expected
big points,
And it was on newsstands after the election results. So in fact, it was really just based on my very strong feeling from reporting from Dublin that Sinn Féin were going to experience a huge surge, limited obviously by the fact that they only stood 42 candidates, but that the tide was really very much moving in their favour. But the piece really tried to capture how painful that is for some older voters, basically, and some people with more links to the Troubles. So sort of balancing this enormous sense of hope voting for a new party who haven't been in government in the Republic before. Their very unique messaging on housing and on health and where that had come from, because they had really put in quite a concerted effort to appear a credible party of government. You know, their housing spokesman, Owen O'Brien, who was sort of the star of the election campaign for Sinn Féin, has written a book on the housing crisis, which is quite highly regarded across the board. And he's considered quite an authority on the subject. So it was kind of trying to capture where that surge was coming from and what people were really thinking about Sinn Féin, but then also how they're not exactly a conventional political party, how people have, you know, people think of them beyond the pale in a way that there is no equivalent of in British politics, even with something like UKIP, that there are such like deep feelings there. As well as ongoing reservations about the party leadership and so on, their ongoing links to dissident republicanism or to ex-IRA figures and so on, that mood and that balance, which was borne out in the election result itself, where over 65s resolutely did not give Sinn Féin a surge. Right. But for every other generation, they massively moved towards Sinn Féin.
And Anand, Downing Street will have been hoping the Irish government were going to be an absolutely key ally in the next mm-hmm. round of the Brexit talks, right? And it was that relationship between Johnson and Leo Varadkar was very important in getting us to the deal in November. Number 10 will now be scrambling. We don't know what complexion of government we're going to have, do we? But they'll be scrambling to try and understand what this will mean, won't they, for Brexit?
Yeah, I think we all are. I mean, the first and foremost, the British government want the Republic to have a government. They want someone authoritative round the table in the council when the mandate's being discussed. Because remember, out of all the other member states, the Republic of Ireland's economy is most exposed to Brexit. And in that sense, it's in their interest more than any other member state to say, look, calm down, everyone. We need to find a way to make this trading relationship work. So if it takes the Irish a long time to put together a government, or if you end up with a government with a slightly different approach to Brexit than that of the previous one, that could spell trouble for us.
And Alva, we're all obsessed with Brexit here, obviously, mm-hmm. and it will have an impact on the Irish economy, inevitably. But did that play in the election campaign, really?
Absolutely not. It literally wasn't an issue. It was an issue for, I think, 1% of voters. People didn't talk about it at all. It was about the really bad housing crisis and about healthcare. And now we're in a situation where Ireland probably won't have a functioning government. It will have a caretaker government under Leo Varadkar until they manage to elect a new Taoiseach in the Dáil after coalition negotiations.
But it could be
months without a proper government and no sort of proper leadership on Brexit.
I mean, I can't tell you how I know this, but the great hazard of calling elections is that you don't get to decide what they're about. Yeah. And, you know.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
very true. And you can think an election's going to be about Brexit and it can turn out not to be about Brexit.
I think that can happen.
Yeah. And suddenly we're going to have to start thinking about a border poll, aren't we? At least that will be an issue Sinn Féin will be repeatedly trying to force onto the agenda.
Well, they've started talking to the European Union already, or talking at the European Union about this. It makes the European Union's position quite interesting, not least given the shenanigans that happened earlier on with Scotland and that display on the Commission building, which...
Yeah, this was this projection onto the society side of the Commission building. Yeah, leave a light on for the Scots. Let's talk briefly about the very long Labour leadership contest, which I think I'm right in saying still has about 50 days to go.
Wow.
you're all obviously watching it very closely. I mean, it looks, Alva, if we take nominations from grassroots Labour parties to be a reasonable proxy for how members are going to vote, it looks as though Keir Starmer is way ahead. Mm-hmm. But today he's made a series of pledges, quite a few of which are aimed at showing that he's sort of not going to ditch Corbynism, including... Mm-hmm. Going ahead with scrapping tuition fees. What do you make of that?
I mean, it's really interesting because from talking to Labour MPs on the right or the moderate wing of the party, I think that they have this sense of not really knowing what Keir Starmer stands for.
I think that's true on all wings of the party. Yeah.
And sort of what, you know, he's making his pitch to a reasonably pro-Corbyn membership and people are wondering whether that's really him or whether he's, you know, whether he's softer than that. And I think, you know, on the right wing of the Labour Party, they're hoping that that won't be the case and that he's just being pragmatic. But I think as time goes on, it will become clearer that he really believes it. That's my hunch. And I think that's probably what these pledges are about, and he would be more aligned with those Corbyn principles than maybe we would have expected.
Mm. Paul, what do you make of a leadership candidate tying themselves to quite a few policies 5 years out from a general election?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? And things like tuition fees are massively regressive. But I suppose, you know, he must feel that he has to do that for a reason. Part of the curiosity of Keir Starmer, I guess, and, you know, I don't know anything about him really, is he doesn't have much of a hinterland. So he hasn't been in Parliament very long.
He doesn't have much of a political hinterland that, yes, in the way that...
His role as DPP also, you know, he has tried to use some of that, but really it does limit your the extent to which you can express views on particular issues. And so we don't really know who he is. And there'll be a lot of people, sort of unreconstructed Blairites, I suppose, who will be thinking, he's just saying this to get elected, it'll all be fine. And as it turns out, I don't know which way, but a large chunk of people are going to end up disappointed if he wins, I guess.
Yeah, but it can be an advantage sometimes, can't it, that different people can project onto you what they hope you believe. But he seems to be trying to sort of nail things down a bit, doesn't he, with these
And I would say, fair play to him actually coming out with some policy ideas. I mean, I accept that it is arguably madness to commit yourself to something like this so far out from it, from an election. But I sort of appreciate that he's doing it, because I wasn't very impressed on a personal level by this front runner who, as far as I could tell, was just sort of trying to slide under the radar and, you know, and sort of to the leadership after establishing quite an early lead. I think that it's just sort of, it's not very exciting and ultimately leaves people in doubt about what you really mean. Because, I mean, ultimately that's so disingenuous if you're sort of hoping that people will just quietly look at the candidates and decide that you're the most electable and then plump for you. I think he's acting in good faith, I think.
And simultaneously, you've got Rebecca Long-Bailey, who might have expected to be the front runner based on the fact that she's the left-wing candidate. We know party members are pretty left-wing. We think Jeremy Corbyn supports her. Certainly, he's kindly lending her his office to conduct media interviews in. That would seem to be a signal of
and all of his media staff
support, yeah. Given, you know, although he hasn't publicly said he supports her. She's busy, to some extent, distancing herself, not from Corbyn's policies, but from some aspects of the way the party has been run. It's quite interesting, isn't it, that what might have seemed to be a winning, you know, ticket, which was Corbyn's support, is now, after that election result, a little bit more double-edged.
And the thing I find really interesting is, I mean, how far could Rebecca Long-Bailey have moved from Corbyn while taking Corbynite supporters with her? Because, yeah, she was already the sort of endorsed Corbyn successor candidate. I think she probably would have been freer than she thinks to say all the things that she had disagreed with. And she really didn't need to toe that line. Also, probably the Green New Deal wasn't her most impressive achievement under Corbyn. She sort of picked some unusual things. Now she's coming out and criticising certain aspects of Corbyn's leadership, but she could have, dare I say, been her own woman a bit more, and still probably lots of pro-Corbyn people who liked Corbyn's policies would still see in her a good continuation of all the important values of Corbynism. Mm.
Paul, which of the candidates do you think might have the capacity to unsettle Boris Johnson and unsettle this Tory party that we now have?
Keir Starmer probably stands the best chance of doing that. I think it's probably he is the candidate. I don't think, frankly, for a number of reasons, one of them possibly hubris, but, you know, Number 10 are not going to be quaking in their boots about any of these guys. But I think Keir is the one that they would like least. I do feel, I think, again, you're totally right, that Rebecca Long-Bailey is in a really invidious position in a way, because, you know, the membership in certain quarters, I think, will brook very reluctantly any criticism of Corbyn. Mm. But equally, it is farcical to try and pretend that everything went fine. And so that act of political triangulation is, when you game it through in your head, is actually really quite a difficult thing to do.
Right. As I say, only 50-odd days to go. So we'll see how that one plays out. Bye-bye. And we couldn't quite squeeze it in this week, but just a quick update on what's been going on in the US.
The reason that we won tonight in New Hampshire, we won last week in Iowa.
The second big test for the Democratic Party nominees ended up favouring Bernie Sanders last night as he declared victory in New Hampshire. Pete Buttigieg, who's said to have won Iowa, came in second, followed surprisingly by Amy Klobuchar. And the former Vice President Joe Biden finished in a dismal fifth place. But he's already in South Carolina for the next caucus, where he'll be hoping to pick up a much needed win. We'll be keeping you posted on all of the latest from the US as the election campaign rolls on. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Rory Carroll, Gwyn Topham, Anand Menon, Alva Ray and Paul Harrison. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.